listening to the Social Media Church Podcast, a place for conversations with church leaders about social media. This is episode number 27, and I am your host, DJ Chuang. Thank you for tuning in again. On this episode, you'll hear my conversation with Douglas Estes, the author of a book titled SimChurch, Being the Church in the Virtual World. Before I share with you the conversation I had with Douglas Estes, I want to read an excerpt from the book about the meaning of presence, whether that's online or in the physical world. This is a section from SimChurch titled, The Essence of Presence, on page 60. If we want community to flourish in the virtual world, we'll need to scrutinize our learned understanding of presence. Most people raised and educated in the Western world think of presence as being present as a physical act. In grade school, we learned to answer present when the teacher took roll because our bodies were there, even if our minds were outside running wild and free. We have been taught to think of ourselves as being present whenever our body are. We have been taught to think of ourselves as being present wherever our bodies are, even if our minds or hearts or spirits wander. Though defining presence simply as the location of our bodies is one of the foundational bricks of the modern Western understanding of the world, it is not a God-given or biblical idea. Westerners' ideas about presence mostly trace back to René Descartes, one of the fathers of the modern Western worldview, the I think, therefore I am guy. In his influential book, Meditations, Descartes sets out the premise of what we refer to as mind-body dualism, the idea that a human being has two distinct body parts. The idea that a human being has two distinct parts, a body and a mind, or soul. Though his ideas on the split between body and mind had an incredible impact on the Western worldview, it is less well known that Descartes, in his Meditations, also wondered what would happen if a super powerful demon were able to create a dreamlike world to entice people in their own minds. In this dreamlike world, these people were able to access only their minds, which to Descartes include their senses, but not their bodies. Would this dreamlike world be real? Descartes decided that it could not be real, no matter what their perceptions, minds, may tell them. It must be imaginary because all they can be sure of is their physical essence, bodies. In other words, it's not what we can perceive that matters in our knowing about the world. It's what we can touch. Even though we might be able to see, hear, smell, in a dream, our senses or minds or souls ultimately would be misleading us. Descartes' idea about the world not only separated the mind from the body, but also ascribed to each of them two different properties. Only the body is capable of interacting with the real world, the soul cannot. Thus, Western society came to believe there is a disconnection between what is real, what we can prove by physical experimentation, and what is imaginary, what we see or perceive in our hearts or our mind's eye. While Descartes' ideas were cutting-edge philosophy in the 17th century, the idea that we cannot know anything outside our physical experience is not always helpful, especially for people of faith. Take a look at Hebrews 11:1. Descartes' ideas about the way we can know about our world are so powerful that they underpin all modern Western thought. To make matters worse, Westerners, including well-meaning Christians, take Descartes' ideas for granted as the right way to speak of the mind and the body. In other words, because of the way Westerners are raised and educated, they learn from an early age that it is what we experience in the body that is primary. In other words, because of the way Westerners are raised and educated, they learn from an early age that it is what we experience in the body that is the primary form of reality, or more specifically, how we know something is real. When Westerners become Christians, they must unlearn this viewpoint to a certain degree as they begin to make room for God's agency and providence that most times cannot be proven real with physical evidence. Therefore, when we talk about presence, the Western worldview influences our understanding and holds that being present, existing somewhere or somewhen, aware of your environment and relating to it, it is a physical activity. And as we discuss presence in both physical and virtual worlds, we Westerners must remember that we have been taught to evaluate our sense of presence, and by extension, how we relate to other people, and by extension, our understanding of community, through Descartes' lens of the world, not a neutral or biblical lens. Descartes' tremendous influence results in a set of laws that govern the Western understanding of presence that ushered in the modern era, but are starting to unravel at the beginning of the 21st century. Critics unwittingly use these laws in their arguments against virtual churches, even though these arguments are rooted in the values of the modern worldview and not biblical values. If we follow the standard modern view of what it means to be present, the physical experience of something or someone, it means that my prayer life, telephone conversations, watching astronauts in outer space, and online gaming are all imaginary experiences that aren't real because I can't experience them in full with my body. In other words, even though I can perceive of them, they are not mediated by my body, and hence, according to the Western worldview, I cannot know with certainty whether they are real or illusory. Let me give some examples to ponder to ascertain our immersion in the modern worldview. Modern Western worldview. What does it mean to be present at church? Five examples. If I come to worship service on Sunday morning but spend the whole time thinking about the Dallas Cowboys' upcoming football game that afternoon, am I present? If I go to a megachurch and sit in seat 84K in the mezzanine and watch the pastor on an overhead LCD TV, am I present? If I am working in the nursery at my church during the service and hear the pastor over the piped-in speaker system, am I present? If I break my leg and am stuck in the hospital on Sunday morning but pray for the pastor's message during the service and listen to it over the radio, am I present? Be careful with this one. More than the others, it will reveal just how much you have been conditioned by modern philosophy rather than the Bible. If I break my leg and am stuck in the hospital on Sunday morning, but I have my laptop and log in to Second Life and attend services at the Anglican Cathedral, am I present? To all, according to the Bible, but not necessarily the modern worldview, the answer is yes. Although, interestingly enough, the first example is the least biblical and the most Western, and the one many readers will give the strongest yes to. That is just a short excerpt from a book, which is a paperback. It's not too big, 200-some pages, but it is chock full of very thoughtful philosophical as well as ecclesiological reflection about what the church is about and the virtual world and what that means to how we relate and how we are part of the body of Christ. So here's my conversation with Douglas Estes, where we drill down a bit more about why he wrote the book and how he approached such a big subject. This is DJ Chuang, and talking with me on this episode of the Social Media Church podcast is Doug Estes. He's the author of a book titled Sim Church, and I find it to be quite instrumental in opening my eyes to what technology introduces in terms of how we are the church and how we do church online. So, Doug, thank you for joining me to chat.
Sure. Great to be here and great to talk about it.
So to describe for our listeners, how did you come about writing this book from such a fresh perspective about what technology does for us in the church?
Yeah, that's a great question. I have always been a technophile. I've always been interested in how the church intersects with technology. I mean, if you rewind in my life story and go back about, gosh, I think it's about 15 years or so or more now, I was actually interviewed by a religious news organization about me doing evangelism on the internet and just dialoguing with people on the internet back when chat rooms were popular and that sort of thing. So the intersection of technology and church has always been at the forefront of my mind, and it's always been something I've been very interested in. So it was just kind of a natural progression as I've kind of moved ahead in my life and career and to keep asking those questions. And it is something I'm intensely interested in. And it just worked out superbly that my publisher's Honor Band was very great and to work with, and they were very receptive to the idea. And we were able to put together a really good project.
Yeah, and the book is titled Sim Church, Being the Church in the Virtual World. It was published in 2009. So that's a little over 3 years ago. And in .com speed, 3 years is ancient history. So a lot has happened since. Describe a bit of the vision that you unpacked it there, because there are very few church and technology books that really give us a vision for the potential of what this virtual world opens up for us. A lot of it tends to be more of a cautionary stance, but you took it from such a different view. So I wanted you to talk about that.
Sure. The different view that I took came about for basically two reasons, DJ. And the first reason is that when I made the commitment to write this book, I went on Amazon and I went, well, mostly on Amazon, went on the internet, and I looked at, you know, what was being written and what was being talked about with the internet in general, okay, technology in general. And I found that a lot of books and manuals about the internet and about technology generally had very poor ratings and a very short shelf life. They were very usually descriptive, or they had some practical tips that were useful in that year, but as you said, a couple of years later, would tend to be very old. And the problem with writing on technology is it can seem very dated very rapidly. So I was concerned about that. But then the biggest issue for me, I think, was in doing this project, I really wanted to do something that was inherently theological more than technological. And by that, what I mean was I really wanted to not understand the technology and then try to apply it back to practice of the church. I wanted to understand the practice of the church first and then think about that in light of technology. And I think that's a huge difference between the two approaches. So one of the interesting stories, or at least interesting to me, was the process by which I wrote Sim Church, because I actually did not do anything with technology at all, did not study it, did not research it, did not do anything with it in the writing of this book until I had actually gone back and taken a couple of months as a little mini sabbatical and just had a massive crash course on ecclesiology. Every book I've ever wanted to read about the church for the last 2,000 years, I made sure I read. I read things that were everything from second century all the way up to modern Roman Catholic views of the church. I just tried to make sure that if anything else in writing this book, I understood the church, I understood its theory, and I understood its theology. And so only then did I allow myself to go into the technological aspects armed with what I feel like was a very strong command of ecclesiology. So the reason why the book came out the way it did is because I wanted to base all of my arguments on the practice of the church. I did not want to argue from a pragmatic position. Now, I know that when people read the book and they'll email me or they talk to me or they grab me at a conference, they'll say, your book is really pragmatic. And I will say, you know, not really, because there's a lot of different ways you could just describe what's going on. And there's nothing wrong with that, by the way, but you could just describe what's going on and then sort of diagnose it. Rather than doing that, I wanted to start at the very beginning, talk about what it means to be a church, and then see what virtual churches and online churches and internet campuses and those sort of things, what they look like in the light of a real church. So that's what makes SimChurch at its heart very different than probably any other book I know out there that deals with internet campuses and online church.
Yeah, exactly. And not only did you do your theological and ecclesiological work, you also did a great job in terms of philosophical and relational and spiritual, kind of the immaterial part of how we relate to each other. And I thought that was just so meaty in how you unpack that.
Well, thanks. I appreciate that. And I think that what's interesting is that's what's allowed SimChurch to, I think it will allow SimChurch to have a longer shelf life and be useful. I mean, even in just the last couple of weeks, there's been several faculty members, three faculty members at three different seminaries in the U.S. who've contacted me about how they can basically, you know, use this as a textbook in their classes because they're just studying with their students, what does it mean to be a church? And they found that my unpacking of the church and sort of applying it in a unique way is actually very helpful for their students to think about what it means to be the church. And so to me, that's what makes writing SimChurch was so special to me, was to have that kind of thing.
Now, in the course of 3 years since the book was published, what kind of feedback has surprised you as people read and interact with the book and with you?
Well, the feedback was actually kind of interesting because one of the things that surprised me from the get-go of the release of the book was the type of feedback that I received. There are a lot of people that surprise me because they just hate the idea from the get-go and they're not willing to consider it. And that surprised me a little bit. There was an AOL poll, AOL News did a poll shortly after SimChurch came out, and basically they asked, have you ever been to an online campus or anything like that? Now, this was a couple years ago. And people said, no, I've never been. And they asked, do you think it's real or legit? And again, almost everyone was like, no, you know, it's not real, it's not legit. That was a little bit surprising. I think the other thing that was really surprising to the reception of my book is that I think there was a lot of assumption made by lots of friends of mine, people who knew I was writing it, people that were going through that journey with me. They assumed that the cool side of the Christian church would really like the book and that the traditional side of the church would really hate the book. And in writing it, I just kind of assumed that as well. I assumed, you know, traditional people are really going to hate this and the cool people will really like it. But actually what I found is kind of almost the opposite. I found that a lot of people who would we as a church would look at least in North America or the U.S., we would look at being some of the cooler people in the church. They didn't actually like it. But at the same time, I got lots of encouragement from people that I'll just call traditional Christians, pastors who pastor, you know, average brick and mortar churches. I mean, average only because not in what they're doing personally, but just because of if you drove by the church, it would just seem like an average church. You know, I got lots of positive feedback from them. And a lot of course, because I'm on the academic side of things, I got a lot of nice feedback from the majority of academics who interacted with the book. And so that's what surprised me, because it was not seen very well by some of the cooler groups. But it was received very well by just a lot of more traditional Christians. And the reason why I think that is as I've reflected on it over the last couple of years, is that the traditions of the church and the fads that the church goes through, a lot of times if your focus is on being cool or interesting in culture, then those fads and those kind of things are important to you. And as a result of that, if a new idea comes along and it doesn't fit that fad, then you don't really like that. Whereas if you are a little bit more traditional and you're just trying to do your day job, which is to see people love Jesus and have a relationship with him, then you get excited about anything the church does that could basically move the church forward, even if it's outside your context or even if you don't fully agree with it. And I think that's the thing that was the interesting reaction that I found to the book.
Wow, that's amazing. And not only do you have an academic background and you've done really good academic work in this book, you've also pastored. So you've pastored in San Jose, which some have described as the heart of Silicon Valley. And I've flown through there a couple of times, and the airport is very wired. So how did technology play out in your particular church context?
Well, that's an interesting question, because I have had the chance to do pastoral ministry. I am sort of an academic in my mind and a pastor in my heart, so to speak. And so I do a lot of academic stuff with my writing, but at the same time, I've been a pastor pretty much for about 15 years now. And I've pastored outside New York City in San Jose, California. And now, as of 2 months ago, I'm outside of Phoenix, Arizona, and loving the new context here and just a new ministry and new excitement here. But as far as San Jose, it's very interesting that you bring this up, DJ, because San Jose was kind of interesting in some ways. First of all, my context in San Jose, a lot of people, if you just kind of saw my bio, you might assume that my context in San Jose was to be in a very, you know, sort of upper middle class, urban professional, everybody has technology coming out of their ears context. And that actually wasn't my context in San Jose. I actually pastored a missional church in a bad section of San Jose, and it was a highly multi-ethnic church, whereby on any given Sunday, you know, you would have probably 7 or 8 major different ethnicities and different backgrounds. So English was the language that was spoken in service, but once you went outside the church, there's no telling what language you would hear. Chinese, Vietnamese, Spanish, I mean, you go down the list, and it was there, Tagalog, and you go down the list. So the thing is, that was actually my context. And the interesting thing about my context is that I didn't actually see technology implemented in Silicon Valley a lot more than I did in other parts of the country. I mean, you would assume that that would be the case, but at the same time, there's still a very strong relational aspect to everything that we do at church. And a lot of people I talk to, even people that worked at Apple and a lot of other larger companies, Microsoft, a lot of other companies that are out there, eBay, that went to my church, their main focus was, hey, we love technology, but we really want to come to church to focus primarily on church and have technology be the secondary aspect of that. Now, having said that, there are one or two churches out there that I know of in Silicon Valley who are a little bit cutting edge when it comes to technology, but not at the degree that you might think. At least that was my experience. And I think there's a lot of uniqueness in Silicon Valley, a lot of unique issues that go into the personal relationships and the ministry with families and the ministry of people there that make it not quite what people would assume. Again, you know, the assumption would be everything would be super technologically focused. And I haven't really found that to be the case while I was there.
Yeah, and that's what's interesting to me is I connect with church leaders around the country. Most of my context is just across the United States. And the most innovation in terms of, say, church media doesn't really happen in L.A., even though that is kind of the media capital. And the most innovation, so to speak, of technology doesn't really happen in Silicon Valley. It's happening in Oklahoma City, and it's happening in Florida and just these different places. So it is very interesting. Have you taken that with you as you've moved to different parts of the country? You mentioned San Jose, New York, and now Phoenix.
Well, I think that how I've taken it with me is that because of the U.S. being the way it is, and meaning, you know, we are a country where if you move from one city to the other, there are some differences, but it's not not major. You're not doing cross-cultural anything at that point. Pretty much, it's been very similar. Now, but as a side note, as you know, I lived in Ireland for the last year, doing a postdoc over there at a seminary. And while I was over there, that was definitely a very interesting context of me talking about technology in the church, because for many of them, the idea of integrating technology in the church seemed to be sort of an odd idea that they were uncertain about. And so as a country, we've been much more, in my opinion, an early adopter than other countries have in the world, although that's not always the case. Depends on which country you're talking about. But at least in my experience in Ireland, and working with pastors over there as a side ministry while I was there, there was lots of questions about technology, but there was also a little bit of skepticism about how it worked. And but still, at the same time, an openness to see what God could do. And that's sort of where that vision part comes in that you're talking about, where some of the more cutting edge things may not come out of Silicon Valley. It may come out of Oklahoma City. It may come out of other places. And that's because you have a vision of a few people. And that's what I encountered a lot, for example, in my church in San Jose, is that a lot of the people that came to BBC did not have a vision for doing something revolutionary with technology, because they did that in their jobs already. So they didn't feel the need to do that. They wanted to be revolutionary in other areas. And I think that's where it's key, because as pastors, we need to tap into what our people are thinking, what they want to do. So as an example, if someone were to call me up and say, well, you know, Douglas, what are you going to technology wise in your new church? Are you going to try to push them in this direction or that direction? And I would say largely, no, I just want to hear them, hear what their heart is, what God has laid on their heart to do in their ministry context, and then start vision casting through that. Now, technology may be a big part of that, and I may, you know, we may suggest technology as a way of doing it, and I'm hoping to be innovative in the next couple of years in technology. But at the same time, it's one of those things where, you know, there's several different ingredients that go into mixing that together.
Say a little bit more about that. What are the ingredients that would be helpful for a church leader to think through in terms of what technologies to use and what not to use in being the church?
Okay. Well, I think as far as the ingredients that would go into that for a pastor, that what to use and what not to use, first of all, I think that not every pastor necessarily needs to be cutting edge in every way. So I think, you know, you want to pick and choose which battles you're going to fight with your individual church and decide where are the areas you want to be cutting edge. Of the 330-some thousand churches in America, I don't think every one of them needs to be cutting edge in technology. At the same time, I think that increasingly, the more we can leverage as a whole churches using technology, the better it will be. So I think the ingredients are, is number one, you need to have a vision for using technology in newer and faster and better ways in your church. Number two is, I think you need to have a vision for recruiting a team of people for whom that's a passion. And without that team of people, it's going to be a lonely walk for the pastor to try to do something themselves. And so I would never recommend a pastor do something if the heartbeat of the church is completely in a different direction. But assuming that you have a team of people, because I'm sure there probably is technology is throughout our lives, so I can't imagine there not being a group of people who are excited about technology. But, you know, gather together that group of people about technology and then set some reasonable goals. For example, a reasonable goal may just be, let's integrate social media more in our church. Let's use social media as a tool for outreach. I would just start with some basic goals that the church can do. And then once you've accomplished those goals, then create new and bigger goals for that team and that group of people, evaluating, of course, but creating new and better goals for that team of people to do, and then keep casting a vision for more and more things that you can do.
That is so helpful. Thank you, Douglas. And we're in 2012 now. We are past the 1 billion mark of monthly active users on Facebook, the largest social network out there. Mm-hmm. Other social networks are growing steadily, whether that's Twitter or Pinterest or Google Plus and so on. Where do you see this heading?
I was going to say, I finally relented and joined Google Plus the other day. So where I think I see this going, that's a great question, because one of the things that was unfortunate, I suppose, after SimChurch came out, is that the interest in online ministry in from my perspective, and some of the other guys you've interviewed may you know sort of give you a different opinion, and I would certainly be open to that. But some of the interests that I saw in it kind of hibernated for a little while, and I think a lot of that had to do with the state of the economy, with the state of sort of where technology has been over the last couple of years. So when people ask me, hey, what's up with technology in the church? Where is it at right now? I always say, look, it's kind of like the market is bearish right now. The bear is kind of waiting to see what's going to happen before coming out of his cave. And I find that to be true because a lot of churches that when after Sim Church came out, they would contact me and they'd say, how do we start this? How do we get this going? And I would kind of give them some suggestions and resources. And then several of them, like one of them called me later, one of their lay leaders said, you know, we talked about doing it, but we actually had to lay off staff because the economy got so bad. So it's not anything that we can do for another couple of years. And I think that you can't really look at the church without looking at the socioeconomic situation that goes on around the church, the world that we live in. And I think that the last couple of years have been really hard for a lot of churches here in the U.S. I know I can certainly sympathize. A lot of the churches I was connected with, and I would say it's true, a lot of the churches I was connected with both in the U.S. and in Europe have all been hit very hard by the economy and the social environment and that sort of thing. And I think that many of them are taking a wait-and-see approach. And we've seen even what happened with Facebook and some of the other things that have come out. We had a resurgence, but there's still a lot of wait-and-see with what's going on there. And I mean, like, even financially and with some other areas. I think what's going to happen is at some point that's going to break. The dam is going to break. And you're going to have a bullish aspect again on technology in the church. It may not be for a couple of years, but I think it's going to happen. And I think one of the things that will propel it is that we're probably due. Now, I hate to be predictive, so don't quote me, but I suspect that some of the social networks that we have now are either going to run their course and will be replaced. Or we'll have to make a rapid change to the next generation. That won't be this year, obviously, but in a couple years, 5 years, 10 years down the road, you're obviously going to have some switchovers and you're going to have some things that are going to happen. It's just going to move too fast. And at that point, I think if that hits at the same time, then you're going to see the church again become much more bullish about getting involved with technology. And my hope is that the church will not have lost too much ground between now and then, because that's the danger. Because during this time, you know, the people that are envisioning the next wave of technological advancement, they're already envisioning it. They're already doing it. We just don't really know what they're doing. We don't know what it's going to be. And the problem is that the church is too bearish at this point. They will just skip that. They'll miss out on that. And you'll have the quote unquote next Facebook or the next whatever, and it will already have be making an impact before the church realizes several years too late, oh, you know, we need to go ahead and get on board with that. So that's just my hope, is that the church, even though I recognize it's a little bearish right now, needs to understand that this is not going away, and we need to be engaging and looking for the next steps to make our ministry better. And there are a few people out there who are doing that, but we just need more. I would argue we need more.
Well, Douglas Estes, thank you so much for chatting with us on this Social Media Church podcast. Your insights are invaluable.
Sure. Glad to be here. Thanks, CJ.
Thank you, Douglas Estes, for joining us on the Social Media Church. And you can check the show notes for a link to the book, which I highly recommend. It is a book worthy of buying and discussing and working through with your church leadership team for however it is that you want to be using social media as an extension of your ministry and your church and witness in the real world. Because people are connecting online. Over a billion on Facebook every month are connecting online, and that number is just going to increase. And if we're not present there, the place will stay dark. And even those of us that are a small light, a light in the midst of darkness, can shine brightly. So check the show notes at socialmediachurch.net. Be sure to subscribe. And I'd love to hear your feedback. What thoughts did he provoke in you as you listened to Douglas share about the pace of technology and the shape of ecclesiology? You can tweet me or respond on Facebook, even email me at socialmediachurch.net. And you can call in your comments, and I can incorporate that into a future episode as well, so you can join the conversation. The number is 949-353-2216. The number again, 949-353-2216. Let me wrap up this episode of the Social Media Church podcast. My name is DJ Chuang, and until next time, let's stay connected online.